Happy Earth Day. It's Earth Day. How about that? It has been, I learned last week, 6 months. So about the middle of last week when it felt like it shifted into spring. At that point it had been 6 months since Winnipeg had experienced double digits on the positive side of zero. Yeah. So if we're feeling it, like there's a reason, you know? And feeling it on the, boy, that's a long haul side, but also on the other side, you know, the kind of woo-hoo, right? When that happens, I sort of feel like I want to say to people that I know, you know, only encounter this part of our gathering as podcast folks that are from warmer climates, I feel like on their behalf, I want to say to all of us, yes, winter is also beautiful, but sometimes it feels cold and long. And when things start to thaw, we feel ourselves coming alive again in some mysterious ways that don't have just to do with breathing in and breathing out, but feeling alive in a different way. I was on my way out of our gathering here last week with Zeke and Shireen and a bunch of their clan, and Shireen was like, wait, there's something green! and sure enough, right by the wall, like if you're walking out this way toward Balmoral, just close to the last corner before Balmoral, in a nice, warm, sunny corner of the building where there's some composting plants left from last year, there were some sturdy, perennial somethings coming up alongside the wall. And when we went to look at one of them, then we found more of them. And then later that day, when I was at home, suddenly a photograph of a similar green shoot appeared on my phone, courtesy of some warm spot at Zeke and Shireen's. And there's something inside of me and outside of me that feels like it's stirring, like it's waking up, you know? Now, the person who used to cut my hair says that even our hair grows faster in the summer. I don't know if this is verifiable, but I've never explored it. But
I feel that it does.
Yeah, well, she sees a lot of hair, and she just said, no, this is just like gravity. It's a fact.
This is so weird to me, because we need our hair so much more in the winter.
Yeah. This is like from an evolutionary point of view, this just feels so wrong, doesn't it? Randall, I'm not sure. I'm not sure there's a climate that's going to solve this. Yeah. You want me to edit that?
Yeah.
I've never explored that as a fact, you know, but it feels really congruent to me with the way other things that are alive seem to behave differently in the warmth of the sun. And I guess that might all feel resonant and kind of nice and so on, but is it true? Like, is it true that we're more alive in the warmth of spring than in the cold of winter? And if I pursue that line of inquiry, it's pretty short order for me, at least, that I come to the question, does it matter if that's true? This might not even be the experience that everyone has. I expect that there are people who feel more invigorated by winter than they do by summer, that find summer really quite oppressive. So what I just described wouldn't be resonant for them, but if I feel new life stirring inside of me as I see and feel it stirring around me in the springtime, then what I can say is that truly is my experience. That's the experience I'm having. And I mention that not to make any point about what constitutes the last word about what is true. We won't even save that for another day, because that's not a day. but rather to point out that sometimes we have powerful experiences or beliefs or longings that we want to put words around, and so we try to do that. But once we get into it, once we start trying to do that, we realize that our words are not adequate for the experience. We realize that what we're trying to describe won't fit nicely into the categories that words form, the categories of ideas or concepts or facts. And we realize that there are things that matter a great deal to us as people that are not propositions at all. They are not things that we know head first, but things that we know in other ways. And I so appreciated the space that Jason invited us into this morning in the community time. That's the idea that there are profoundly important things that we know in ways other than with our rational process, and that those things are true. That's not a new idea. That's not a new human experience. And John of the Cross in Dark Night of the Soul does a remarkable job of exploring all of that. There's a more contemporary thinker that's had a lot of impact on me around all of this. A thinker who wrote a book at the end of the 1950s called Personal Knowledge. Writer and thinker named Michael Polanyi. And Polanyi authored the term tacit knowing. I remember the first time I encountered tacit in another setting, because I first encountered Polanyi's work probably 20 years ago or so. Maybe not quite that long, but quite some time ago. And before I started to do any work, kind of hands-on work in the orchestra world. And then when I was working in that world, the conductor that I was working with instructed the orchestra that a section was tacit, by which she meant silent. If it's tacit for the orchestra, you don't make any sound. And to me, that was not a connection she was trying to make. I just had my own little moment with it and kind of went, that's really interesting. That this thing that Polanyi is talking about, which we'll unpack a little bit in a moment, this way of knowing, would also be something in the English language, which is our currency for ideas, is language, that we would use the same word for an entire group of people who are there to work together to express something, that we would use that same word for their silent expression of something. That was intriguing to me as a picture of tacit knowing. Tacit knowing is the kind of knowledge that is difficult to transfer to another person by means of writing it down or verbalizing it. That's a good general way to think about what constitutes tacit knowledge. It's something that we know, but it's hard to codify that something, and it's hard to make it explicit. So we already know, if we're paying attention to the definitions, that there are all kinds of experiences we have that are like this. But just to illustrate, for example, by way of contrast, Winnipeg is a city in southern Manitoba, is a piece of what we might call explicit knowledge. Okay, we can write that down, we can share it with someone else, and when we share that with someone else, that knowledge has been conveyed. They now know that Winnipeg is a city in southern Manitoba. On the other hand, the ability to do things like speak a language or play a musical instrument or ride a bike, all things that people in this room can do, those are all things that we do. We all speak a language, for instance. Those are all things that we might know, but they all require all kinds of knowledge that is not always known explicitly, even by expert practitioners of that thing, and which are very difficult or even impossible to explicitly transfer to another person. And some have called that kind of knowledge, this tacit knowing, know-how. As distinct from know what, which is about the facts, or know why, which is sort of about scientific knowledge, or know who, which is social knowledge or networking. So this is know how. Another common illustration of what constitutes tacit knowing is knowing how to drive a nail with a hammer. And when I ran across that one in my research, I latched onto it because my dad, his whole career was a carpenter. And even when his business grew beyond the point where he was strapping on his tool belt every day, he still loved to be a carpenter. And my dad is old enough that when he started out as a carpenter, you still cut boards to length with a handsaw, and you still nail them together with a hammer and nails. None of this skill saw and air nailer business. You know, it was, you put your hands on it. And he's the guy who taught me how to drive a nail with a hammer. And if I started to try to convey to you with words what he showed me that day, it would be almost entirely a waste of time. Because even if I was so good at math and science that I could talk to you about angles and velocity and resistance and metallurgy and anatomy and physiology and optics, and all of those things that go into driving a nail, and if I could do that with sufficient intricacy and at sufficient length to explain how to drive a nail with a hammer, when I was done, you still wouldn't know how to do it. And in fact, the odds are pretty good that you would never want to try. Right? It would sound so impossibly complex that probably what it would make you want to do more than try to drive a nail is pick up the phone and call Anthony or Aaron or somebody that you know has this skill and say, how much would you charge to come over here and drive a nail? Because I am not going there. Right? That is past my pay grade. But I can clearly remember, Ray and I were having this conversation about memory. We won't even go down that path because I have a clear memory and I know that part of it's made up because that's the way memory works. I have a clear memory of my dad teaching me how to drive a nail. Like, I could take you there. I know it, right? I know that. And even though the science nerd in me knows that I don't know it the way I'm feeling like I do in terms of data, that I'm filling in the blanks of the pieces that I've stored, I know it. Now, those lessons that my dad taught me sunk in well enough that this past summer, when Tyrion wanted to build some of his own parkour obstacles and he and I both realized this was going to involve some nail driving, which is, for some strange reason, something he had not had to do very much to that point in his life, I thought I'd rectify that parental failure and teach him how to drive a nail, you know? And the memory was clear enough that I was able to pass some of that knowledge along to him. Now, nail driving is important, especially if it's part of your way of making a living, but unless that's the case, I wouldn't necessarily think that I was passing something along to Tyrion that I would describe as life-changing or transformative. And so if he didn't get it, if he didn't pick it up that readily, I might be a little bit frustrated. Probably I would express that as frustration with him, but it would probably actually be frustration with me. But other than that, I wouldn't really get too fussed about it because I'd be more likely to just pick up my hammer and give him a hand with the project and suspect that, you know, he'd pick it up as we went along. But what about things that I think are life-changing or transformative? What if those things that I mostly care that much about are things that I also mostly know tacitly rather than explicitly? What if the things that I think are most life-changing and transformative are the sort of knowledge that is really hard to put words around, and when I do try, it seems like I'm turning something I know inside of me into some externalized set of ideas that rapidly devolves into impossibly complex and not very interesting theoretical knowledge? And if you stand back from that just a bit, you might see that without necessarily setting out to do so, I've just described what we might experience as the gap between things that we would use words like faith and religion for, or the gap between something that we might call a spiritual experience and theology. I think one of the most poignant experiences that I have with this whole thing is often in the realm of parents that are in the process of a faith shift themselves. And they are finding that although they feel spiritually alive and engaged, the shape of belief that was handed to them isn't working all that well, maybe not at all. And so they're kind of having to tear that whole system down, like brick by brick. And that might feel kind of energizing and hopeful and liberating, and maybe it's even sort of fun in certain respects. But then they have this experience like they're standing beside this pile of bricks that doesn't seem to form anything tangible, and standing right beside them is their kid, and their kid is holding to their hand, and they're pointing at this pile of rubble in the middle of the room, and they're saying, Mom, Dad, what is that? And we can have a similar experience with anyone we care about. We don't have to be a parent to have this, or anyone that we care to try to communicate about this sort of thing too. Like, it can be a friend or a parent or a grandparent or a colleague, family member, doesn't really matter. Sometimes we have this experience inside of ourselves, like our inner self is saying to some other part of us about this shambolic pile of our formal beliefs, what is that? And it's like the something inside of you that just knew you had to do the deconstruction and start to make the shift, sort of has a panic attack and starts to shut down because you realize that you don't have the sort of answer to the what is that question that you can make explicit or convey in words. And in that kind of moment, I think the most helpful, important thing that we can say to our panicking or our distressed self is something like, tacit knowing is true knowing, even if you can't find the words for it. The things that we know tacitly, we know truly. It's a true way of knowing, which will hopefully help us get unfrozen, but does still leave outstanding the question about how we might share those sorts of things with other people. So how do we convey things we know but have trouble making explicit? How do we convey things that we know tacitly, especially if we regard them as important? Well, what's the hardest part of hammering in a nail? For me, this might be different for you than it is for me, but for me, I think one of the hardest parts is getting the nail to go in straight without bending.
Or without smashing your fingers.
You know what I remember best about my dad's teaching me how to hammer in a nail? My dad taught me that you can steer the nail. A concept that would not have occurred to me on my own. Sometimes, in order to get the nail to go in, you don't hit it straight on the head. You hit it at a bit of an angle. You steer it with your hammer. The simple, explicit explanation of how to drive a nail in straight is hit it straight. The fact of the matter is that you're not driving it into a neutral medium. You're driving it into a reactive medium. Wood's not neutral. There's all sorts of things going on in there. The nail's not mathematically perfect, never mind the hammer or the hammerer. So just hit the nail straight so it goes in straight might convey something explicit, but it does not actually help you drive in a nail. To learn how to actually drive in a nail, somebody needs to do a couple of things. One of them is say, you know what? You can steer the nail. And the other thing is they need to show you that. While my dad was saying to me, Tim, if you want to drive the nail in successfully, you can steer it with your hammer. He had his hammer in his hand, and he was driving in a nail. And he made it look so easy and so obvious that even the little shaver that I was had the courage to just pick up my hammer and try. And yes, you can steer a nail. It does take some practice. But that was the context. So this is important to me in lots of ways. My memory beyond that is that I flattened a lot of nails sideways before that motion was instinctive, but I did get it. I still have it. When I pick up a hammer today, I can still steer the nail at least most of the time. And Tyrion's, you know, coming along. He's getting pretty good at it too. The folks that study these things would say that effective transfer of tacit knowledge generally requires three things. It requires extensive personal contact. It requires regular interaction. And it requires trust. Tacit knowledge can only be revealed through practice in a particular context and transmitted through social networks. That's the way the folks who are trying to put words around something like tacit knowledge conveyance would say it. And in my story, the context and the network was both my family and my dad's workplace, a fairly rich context in terms of personal contact and trust and shared experience. To some extent, tacit knowledge is captured when the knowledge holder joins a community of practice. It is not captured, when we have tidy words for it, but when people experience us doing the knowledge that we're trying to convey. I heard a wise thinker about all of this past week talking about the knowledge of God, belief in God, say that if you're struggling with whether or not you believe in God, one of the sort of obvious paths is to do the sorts of things that people that believe in God do. The odds are pretty good that you will encounter what you truly know about belief in God along that path. If you try to put words around it, it might not be the same words as the people you're sharing the experience with. If you try to make it explicit, it might not match. But that context is a rich one for learning things that are tacit. When it comes to spirituality, when it comes to the ways in which we might say that we know things that have to do with our spirituality, it seems to me that they are more likely to be tacit than explicit, despite all the time and energy that gets put into making them explicit, like this. And that seems to be true whether we feel like we have real clarity about what we know, here's how to drive a nail, son, that came without any hesitation to my dad, or whether we feel like what we know is that we're not sure about something. That's knowledge too, right? We don't tend to think about it that way. If we don't feel sure about something, we might say we don't know that. Oh, no. If we're not sure about something, we know that. We know that we're not sure. That's a super important piece of knowing when it comes to spirituality. That's the entire dark night of the soul in one sentence. I know that I don't know. Zeke, after our gathering last week, I think it was last week, memory, relayed a story about a Muslim cleric that he had heard addressed with a question about the divine, and the cleric's reply, as I remember our conversation, was basically, you're going to have to ask the divine that one. Like, that's about the divine. You really want me to answer that? And that it struck Zeke as a very wise answer. I expect that cleric, given what they do for a living, if they're a practicing cleric, they're in community, they're sharing spiritual experiences with people, having them together, might also say, on further reflection, and by the way, why don't you come and join us in our exploration? Why don't you come and join us in what we don't know together and see what you come to know? The things that are beyond you as well are likely to be revealed to you there. I think one of the reasons an idea like this takes a bit of unraveling and raveling, by the way, that's the same word historically. Did you know that? That unraveling and raveling are basically the same word? I think that's fascinating, especially when it comes to spirituality. And I'm not just talking about like the English modifier, like in terms of the etymology of the word, that's the same thing. I'm not going to pursue that any further. A lot of blank looks. And it only matters to me, but I know it.
It's like saw and unsaw.
Right. Yeah. Excellent illustration. Either way, to get back to what I wrote down, either way, these are the sorts of knowings that are conveyed person to person through things like personal contact and regular interaction and personal trust. They're the sort of things that you have to be in the room to win. And maybe that's why when people who first had this sense that Jesus knew something about God that their present system of belief didn't seem to capture, and they felt compelled to ask Jesus about it, as we have the stories, maybe that's why the reply they got so often was come and see. Mm-hmm. And then what happened is they walked around the countryside together, and they shared food with one another. They ate together. They had conversations. They debated. They tested new beliefs. Often as not, they failed spectacularly. I rather enjoy the contemporary English paraphrase from Peterson when Jesus responds to his disciples and calls them mini faiths, by M-I-N-I, like little. Oh, you mini faiths. You silly people. Why can't you see this? Moments. There's a lot of spectacular failure in that process. And then the people who went and had those experiences invited other people to come and see. And I love that the gospel writers, when they tell the story of people deciding whether they're going to come and see, often that comes out of a conversation with somebody who already accepted the invitation to come and see. And then they go tell somebody else, and when they go tell the other person, and they're like, well, who are you talking about? And they're just like, I suggest you come and see. Personal contact, shared context, all those things that are about tacit knowing. Not come and listen to the theologian explicate. Come and see. That is no less true, by the way, for our kids, if we're parents. It's the personal contact, it's the regular interaction, it's the personal trust parts of that experience that give kids the kind of confidence that they need to explore for themselves, far more than any tidy articulation of a system of belief ever will. Which is not to say don't try to articulate what you believe. This is not an anti-statement about that. It's an and statement about that. Don't be reluctant to live the shambolic reality of I tore the whole thing down and I have a pile of bricks. And when you say to me, son, daughter, when you say, what does that pile mean? I say, I don't know. The idea that that would give our children spiritual confidence feels like a foreign one to lots of us. The idea that that would give a friend trust in us as a spiritual confidant or fellow journeyer feels like a foreign one to us. The idea that that would embolden a colleague who senses that we have some thoughts and feelings and beliefs about this, but they're not sure if we're the right person to talk to. People, there is no substitute for a you too moment when it comes to spiritual journeying. And I'm not saying this could get turned into a strategy, and oh God, would that ever be a failure of communication and idea for me? This is not pretend to be confused so you welcome the confused. Okay, which people turn this stuff into, like, so help me, this happens, and then it's called a methodology of evangelism or something. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the trust that is engendered by a shared experience of a certain kind of knowing that includes I know that I don't know. This is a profound, true way of knowing, and it is not a second-rate citizen. It's not a second-rate way of knowing. For my part, I would rather raise a kid or enjoy a friendship or a relationship in which the other party knows that I am okay with not being able to articulate everything, but that I'm still trying to live out my journey as a spiritual seeker with integrity and freedom and joy. I would far rather. It's not theoretical proof that matters. It's not some tidy worldview or belief system that matters most. It's actually a shared life that matters the most. Including the sharing of things that don't seem like I know them because I can't articulate them. It's that kind of a shared life that builds trust and transforms relationships. That's transformative. It changes us and changes the people around us. When I think about that, as I walk out of here this morning past those sturdy perennials that are pushing their way into the sunshine and coming to life, don't ask me to explain how that happens. And I know there are things explainable about it. It's not just a mystery. And it is also a mystery. And what it stirs in me is not just a mystery, and it is also a mystery. And I know it.